This is the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
This is the Quality News Network. The two leaders of North and South Korea have pledged to formulate a new peace treaty that will formally end the Korean War and replace the 1953 ceasefire. The two countries have also laid out plans to increase joint projects to reduce tensions between them. State media in Myanmar reports that the head of the country's military says he's willing to meet with the detained opposition leader, but conditions must be met. She must agree to end her calls for sanctions against the government. A relative of three women released after the demonstrations in Myanmar said detainees were being divided into four categories: passersby, those who watched, those who clapped, and those who joined in. The last group could face 20 years in prison. The House of Representatives has passed a bill that would make private security contractors, such as Blackwater, subject to prosecution in U.S. courts for incidents that occur overseas. The Senate plans to vote on similar legislation. Iraq's president said today his country has ordered $100 million worth of weapons from China because the U.S. is unable to meet Baghdad's needs. The weapons purchased are to arm the Iraqi police force, in which only one in five officers are armed. An agreement reached today lays the groundwork for a power-sharing deal in Pakistan. Former Pakistani Premier Benazir Bhutto will return to her homeland October 18th. President Pervez Musharraf is running for re-election on Saturday. Chile's late military ruler, General Augusto Pinochet's widow and five children, have been arrested for illegally transferring $27 million out of the country and into foreign bank accounts from 1973 to 1990. Pinochet died of a heart attack last year while under house arrest. He was 91. But before he ever got to trial, more than 3,000 people were killed or disappeared during his military rule. In South Africa, all of the more than 3,000 gold miners are now safely above ground. About 3,200 were trapped 1.5 miles underground yesterday when an accident knocked out power to a main elevator. Federal officials in Southern California say the arrest of 1,300 illegal immigrants in the last 2 weeks was the largest operation of its kind. Authorities say 90% of those captured had criminal records. More than 1,100 were from Mexico. You're listening to the Quality News Network, Science and Business, next.
It won't be long before every business and most individuals will have their own website. Whether they are looking for new clients or posting information of use to their colleagues, the website makes printing brochures and price sheets, press releases, and community notices virtually obsolete. With your own website, you can provide the latest information as it becomes available on new products and services, special offers, and company news. You no longer have to stare at errors or out-of-date information that was printed up in bulk. For organizations, you can bring your message to the public, just as you are knitting tighter relations with your supporters and staff. The people who can make all of that possible are at Byte Technology. Find out more. Byte Technology. See the difference at byte-technology.com or call 831-656-9178. Byte Technology, 656-9178.
1.6 million Chinese-made, lead-based painted badges have been voluntarily recalled by the Boy Scouts of America. 7 and 8-year-old Cub Scouts usually wear the yellow and blue bear wolf badge containing the motto, "Progress Toward Ranks." Parents are being instructed to take them off their shirts. The head of NASA has conceded that China will get to the moon before U.S. astronauts have the chance to make a return visit. NASA's current return date is in 2020. China is expected to get there with an unmanned robotic mission in 2017. Russia celebrated the 50th anniversary of the Sputnik launch. The world's first artificial satellite circled the globe every 90 minutes, opening the door to the space race. Several scientists declared today that pregnant and breastfeeding women should eat about 12 ounces of seafood a week because it helps their babies' brains develop. Currently, federal guidelines say that new mothers should avoid seafood because of possible mercury contamination. The UAW and Ford are discussing more job cuts when they officially return to the bargaining table. The cuts will likely be done through early retirement and buyouts for hourly workers. 27,000 hourly workers left the company in a similar fashion just last year. Close of Wall Street today, the Dow was up 6 points. NASDAQ gained 4. S&P 500 was up 3. Oil currently trading at $81.44 a barrel. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Michael Coleman.
Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 50 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio. Thank you for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Thursday, October 4th, and if you are listening at about 9 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time on Thursday evening, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you are welcome to phone in and talk with our guest, who I'll be introducing in just a moment. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877, the number 4, head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. Or if you have an unlimited long-distance calling plan, you could use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's 304-658-3333. That rings in West Virginia, 304-658-3333. Mail arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I normally try to check the email during the breaks. The show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and as you know, you'll find there links to all of the guests, as well as to the audio archives from the past shows. And so if you've missed a guest and you normally listen via podcast, you can always stop by strictlyconfidentialradio.com, go to the calendar date. It will list the various guests and programs, and you can click there and listen to any of the shows all the way back through July, I believe. You can also find links to the Head On Radio Network main site. You can find out about all the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Networks. There are links there to Strictly Confidential's MySpace page and links to locate the music that you hear on the show to make that a little bit easier for you to find some of the music we play on the show. And I'm so pleased to have you with us this evening. We seem to be coming out of the storm. Again, last night was a dark and stormy night in North Florida. Lots of lightning and booms. So we have a little bit of stormy weather here tonight, too, but it's not nearly as bad as last night. Don't think there'll be any interruptions. Our guest tonight is an amazing guest. You know, this is someone you definitely want to stay tuned to hear. To introduce him succinctly and briefly is probably not possible. In fact, to fully understand the scope of this man, you would have to read a book called Gay Face of God, because his story is truly epic. In fact, I mentioned to him in an email that it probably should be a motion picture. From childhood all the way to where he is today, his adult life as an archbishop, is simply amazing. He was born and raised in Audubon, New Jersey, and at 18 he enlisted in the United States Air Force during Vietnam. Unlike George Bush, whose daddy got him out of it, he was assigned to nuclear security. He received an honorable discharge and entered police work in Pennsylvania. There he received an undergraduate degree in the legal field from the University of Florida. He ran for election, and he was elected in a countywide political position. He unseated the incumbent. He served as the deputy campaign manager for Lawson Lamar, who is the chief assistant state attorney, and that was in his successful run for sheriff of Orange County. Orange County is the Orlando Disney World area. He was sworn in as commissioner of the District Court of Maryland and was an acting United States magistrate. He served there for several years before returning to police work as a sworn police officer in Prince George's County, Maryland. He remained with the police department. He left a few years later to enter Mount St. Mary's Seminary, and then a year later the Archdiocese of Washington, D.C., made a transition to those. He made the transition actually just after he was awarded Police Officer of the Year by the American Legion. He was assigned to St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington. After leaving the seminary in 86, he served as a bodyguard for the Saudi Arabian royal family. Wow. And served as another year as a district court commissioner in Maryland. He's been with the, part of his federal career, he was with the FDA, investigated criminal matters and various law enforcement agencies. He ended his government career in 98 as a GS-4 chief of collections for the U.S. Treasury Department. In fact, helped write one of the laws regarding debt collection for the Treasury. Wow. He is now the Archbishop of the Benedictine Order of St. John the Beloved. He is also a published author and has appeared on radio, television numerous times and received a Ph.D. in pastoral counseling from Sanctus Theological Institute and a Ph.D. in theology. And that was, if I'm not mistaken, St. Paul's College and Seminary. The Benedictine Order of St. John Beloved is a wonderful site. If you if you haven't been by strictlyconfidentialradio.com, go there. You can find links to much more information than I can possibly give you, and direct link to the Benedictine Order of St. John the Beloved. One of the magical things about the site, and you gotta love a guy that would do this. You just gotta love a guy that would do this. when you first get to the site, there's a musical track that plays just as you enter, and what it is, it's a track from Sister Act. If you recall the old Whoopi Goldberg movie, it's a fabulous movie. Whoopi is hiding in a church, and in fact, while she's hiding in that church, she gets sniffs of disapproval from the various folks in the church. But she makes a huge impact on the church for the good. In my estimation, it's a metaphor for the gay community and the church. Wonderful choice. They'd used just a clip from the soundtrack when you enter the site, the high energy portion of the track. But I wanted to play that to give you a feel for. Like I say, you got to love a guy that would do this. I wanted to play the entire song. Is only 3 minutes and 40 seconds. So we're going to run this. It's great fun. And Bob, if you would run "Hail Holy Queen." absolutely fabulous. And in that scene, Whoopi Goldberg is teaching the Catholic Church a few things about inspiration and about spiritual joy and the joy in the Lord. It's a remarkable movie. If you haven't seen it, it's a hoot. And with no more delay, let's welcome the Archbishop Bruce Simpson to the show. Welcome to the show, Mr. Simpson.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm so glad you could join us this evening, and thank you for rescheduling.
That's not a problem. I understand sometimes we have grounds of the system that have to be exercised before we can go on.
Indeed, that was the case. I understand the evening that you were originally scheduled to stop into the show, you stopped by the chat room and someone's was in fact typing in, "Peter, your guest was just arrested." I think maybe you better let us all know that you are not in fact just arrested. Is that the case?
Yes, I about swallowed my tongue when I read that and quickly typed in there, no, I'm not arrested and I haven't been arrested. Of course, they wanted to know who I was, and I said, "I'm the guest, and so I know whether or not I've been arrested." but I'm quite at liberty. I appreciate your pointing that piece before we began to speak. You did hit the nail kind of on the head. I've taken a lot of flack over the years from traditional Catholics for having that as the intro piece of music rather than the heavenly choirs singing, because it symbolized in the movie itself, which was to break open the doors of the church, to bring in an air of freshness, to attract the youth and to bring them in, and taking a song that is very ancient and holy, updating it, giving it some beat, some mood, it worked. And it also meant to say, don't take anything so serious. And that's what I did when I chose that. But I have taken flack for it.
Well, you shouldn't. It did. In fact, when I first visited your site, I did not realize that it was from a sister act. It was one of our chatters who pointed that out to me, and uploaded that for us. It's a lot of fun.
I'm a fan of Whoopi Goldberg, and I've talked with her before and complimented her on her acting in those movies. And as a matter of fact, on YouTube, I pulled up all of the songs that I found on there, and they're in my private collection. And it just somehow seemed very appropriate for the order and for what we're about.
Well, Archbishop Simpson, there are so many things that we could talk about this evening. You, your background and the things you have done are truly epic. If you don't mind, let's kind of start with current events. We have been, of course, covering this situation in Fort Lauderdale on and off for the past month or so. It was the beginning of the potty stories. We actually got kind of burned out. I mean, it was one potty story after the next, as you well know. The news is eaten up with potty stories, and finally we decided no more potty stories. But nonetheless, I did bring this up again recently, regarding the African American Baptist pastors. I believe they have a worldwide Christian. So they appeared with the mayor in paramilitary garb, which we talked about on the show. And in fact, I've discovered too that they had a MySpace page up, complete with gunfire and the whole military. And it was an obvious threat. They were talking in terms of enforcing a Bible Belt type of religious stance in South Florida. In other words, it was obviously a threat to us and our community. And I'm finding out that you were very involved in that. You have actually seen these people. You were there. Is that right?
Yes, I came down to Fort Lauderdale for the purpose of being involved in a press conference of progressive clergy to announce what was taking place, and I joined up with a gentleman by the name of Michael Rayner, who's a wonderful individual involved in AIDS activism and gay rights, and he came by my hotel and said, "Come on, we're going to a meeting." I had no idea what was up, and We ended up at City Hall, and we went in and went upstairs in the elevators, and we got off, and Michael went one way, and two guys in army fatigue escorted me to a door, which when opened, revealed a conference room full of mostly Baptist pastors from the sign-in sheet that I saw. And probably a quarter or more were in combat fatigues and lost combat boots with writing on the back. And then I sat in the back of the meeting. They didn't know who I was. They just saw the collar and assumed I was there for bigotry. And so I was given a seat in the back, and I listened for about 30 minutes to what they had to say about the gay community.
Well, that had to be quite disturbing. Apparently, they were wrapping this rhetoric around the AIDS issue also, not only indicating that it that the public restrooms were rife with activity, which, of course, the police department says what activity. They were saying that we were responsible for AIDS in the areas. Was that a major portion of it?
That was the entire portion. Of course, Mayor Nagel was sitting in the meeting. Reverend Dozier was more or less the ringmaster of the circus that I saw unfold. And essentially they announced their plans, which was, you know, nothing to do really with HIV prevention. That's a smokescreen. Pastors themselves stated what the real agenda is, and that is to run the community out of Fort Lauderdale, lock, stock, and barrel. They don't want the houses open. They don't want the businesses open. They don't want bathhouses, whatever they are, if they're there. They don't want anything. And the second point of their attack is they want to make Fort Lauderdale the Bible Belt of South Florida. So if this was only about HIV prevention, they would be concentrating on the effort that it would take to prevent HIV. They wouldn't be concentrating on a mythological crime spree that, in fact, doesn't exist. They would be addressing prostitution that's heavy in Fort Lauderdale. They would be addressing the topless bars, which lead to sexual activity. They would be addressing all of the cars that park in various places, like they have since cars were invented, for the purposes of straight couples having sex, and I'm sure a few gay couples. None of that was addressed. It's focused on this mythological portion, sex invasion of all things public in the toilet area. And it's a smokescreen. They asked Ogle if they could continue to meet in that government space each month, carry out their plans, which included fundraising to mount this campaign, because they're going to have a revival. They're going to put a big tent over Fort Lauderdale, and they're going to call everybody together and pray away the gay, and then pass the plate four or five times, I'm sure. And this was the agenda of that meeting. And then when it broke up, we left through the doors of that conference room to the rooms of the media. There was a bank of television cameras there, and there was one print reporter who recognized me and kind of asked me to everybody and put me in a little bit of an uncomfortable position because I was amongst the lions, and she was insisting that I give my reaction to what I was hearing. And so I gave a short reaction and said, basically, you know, we will proceed with our own press conference tomorrow, and that's really the place where I'll speak, and this really isn't the place.
Well, it amazes me the parallel in their talking points. It parallels a Nazi propaganda film, actually. There was a propaganda film called The Eternal Jew. The film starts out saying that the average wealth of Germany of Germans, that the Jews were, 10,000 times had the wealth. The next point was they are 1% of the population but control all the politics. The third point was they have better jobs and more money. And here's the point that matches up precisely. Jews are diseased. Insidious Jews spread diseases like rats. It's line for line, if you go through this, this memo about the Nazi propaganda film. And we see this time after time after time after time.
Yes, there's another movie that was made by Leni Riefenstahl called Triumph of the Will, which was is their goal. And if they succeed in Fort Lauderdale, then they'll go on to Miami next, or, you know, whatever other gay spot they think is ripe for the picking. But it is propaganda. It's being fine-honed. I'm sure that they have advisors in the background. And, of course, Dozier is the one who the Son of God talks to and gives him advance notice of election results. And my question was, does he also give him lottery results? Because that I'm interested in. But Dozier announced that, of course, God had told him in a dream that Charlie Crist would be the next governor of Florida, and that this was the kind of connection he had with the Almighty.
Well, it seems that a large number of us in the LGBT community are just not aware of the depth of the threat that's happening. In fact, in one of your articles, you're pointing out that when the Episcopal bishop, when he was the what was his name, Gene
Robinson.
Yes, thank you. That you waited for, I believe, a week or so, and not one leader from the LGBT community stood up to say this is a good thing or congratulations. It was as if have we by and large gone out and found other forms of spirituality, and we just don't get the control these people have.
What you're quoting from is an article that I wrote for The Advocate when I was a regular contributor for them. And yes, I remember that piece. By and large, the Christian right has hijacked the Christian faith in this nation and in other parts of the world. And of course, there's an old saying, "Dear Jesus, please save me from your followers." I think that a large portion of the gay and lesbian community, and I mean bisexuals and transgender, you know, the whole alphabet, has been so turned off by what they've been told in churches is, you know, that they're going to hell, that they're no good, that this or that, that religion has sunk to a priority that's below which bar we might go to next weekend. And so at a religious event can occur, like the election and installation of Gene Robinson, and while the gay community may not have a whole lot of attention at the time, the straight bigoted community did, because he was under FBI protection during his installment. He wore a bulletproof vest. There were snipers on the rooftop because the threat was to be so real when he was installed. So while we may be asleep at the switch, our opposition is not. They're right on top of things. And as an example, when I was at the second day of my trip to Fort Lauderdale during the conference, I noticed one of the individuals that was there the night before standing up on a kind of a concrete barricade, and he telephoto lens, and he took at least 40 pictures of me. And those pictures, I'm sure, are going to be posted far and wide. Wherever they or their contingents meet, my photograph will be posted so that I don't get into any more of their meetings.
This goes back so far. I'm 53, and I remember when I was, 18, 19, we were talking about starting an MCC in Tallahassee. This was way back in the day, and there was somehow or another a meeting came together. It was the leaders of the various churches, and we all assembled in a room on the Florida State University campus, and it was to be a discussion about homosexuality, the Bible, all the standard issues. And this is 40 years ago. There's no talking to the people. You've used the phrase, and quite rightly, I believe, this is a war. We truly are at war. How do we fight this? What do we do? I'm at a loss.
It's not a question that bears a simple answer. And another example I can give you of that is that a little over a year and a half I dealt with death threats from the Texas militia. And I had to give a speech at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And the police there took the threat serious enough that I was under police guard the whole time I was there. I wore a bulletproof vest under my vestments when I appeared on stage. And the topic was gay community, the church, and civil rights. And so we have attacks coming from every quadrant you can think of. There's not progressive or liberal. The problem with this is that the right is willing to mobilize. The right is willing to put money into it. The right is willing to put time into it. The left is not. The left is about fat, sloppy, and happy, sitting on the sofa, watching the latest 2.5 Men. And I wish it wasn't that way, but everything that I've experienced, with some notable exceptions, that's the case.
Well, I think we could make the argument that by and large, the followers actually believe this stuff. Their leaders, their church pastors are telling them the Bible's, and of course they're literalist, and then the word bibliolatry comes in, and all these things. But I think we could also make the argument too that these pastors, these leaders, these people have been to Bible colleges / seminaries. They know better. They know what the. I think we're dealing with a war of lies. Also, I don't think the leadership is at all ignorant.
Mm-hmm. Well, they deal in the distortion of the scriptures, which affects a political and religious end that they seek, which is what Jerry Falwell was all about, which is why he established a law school that was only going to produce Christian lawyers to fight the gay agenda. He was very clear every day he was alive and had somebody listen to him that we were the enemy, and that every dollar he had, every ounce of influence he had, to use the fight against the gay community. Where on the left do we have such dedication to that?
Well, and two, Falwell made the statement that if the gay community did not exist, we'd have to create it, meaning
that's
another
correct.
Form.
That's,
yes, that's another way to make money, yes.
He said that in the back of a limousine with two other people sitting. And one of those people knows someone that I know, and so the quote was passed to me through that method. If the gay community didn't exist, we would have then. We are a cash cow for the right, and all they've got to do is send out a letter to their membership saying the homosexuals are going to take over the state house, or they're going to be adopting kids, or whatever, and the money pours in from their devotees, and with that money, they buy media, they buy exposure, they buy the opportunity to institute propaganda throughout the country and to demonize that which God has created, namely the gay community.
Focus on the Family and the American Family Association. According to some information we covered recently here, it seems to me that that is their primary fundraising mechanism.
Absolutely. Focus on the Family and Concerned Women for America is another one, is headed by a man, surprisingly, that have focused on one aspect or another of the gay community. With Concerned Women of America, they are focused on gay teens, and which is exacerbating the suicide rate in our teen community. And Focus on the Family, of course, is focusing generally on the agenda of the gay community, and I've yet really to see a copy of that agenda. I'm sure you haven't either, but it exists, according to the right. And yes, in the old days, it was the Communist Party. That was used to stir fear in dollars. Well, the communists, defeated the great Reagan administration. He made the entire empire collapse. So it was no longer really socially acceptable to target black people or even Hispanic people. What was left? What was left was the gay community. And they've been beaten up bad ever since. And they're not going to give up until we get to the point in this country where we are organized enough, where we have enough leadership, and we have enough money behind us to fight them on their own terms. And that means controlling Congress to a certain extent, which is what they've been able to do.
Well, these people are so crafty. At this point in time, it seems that they're trying to drive a wedge between the LGBT community and the black community. They're out there saying that we are intent on taking over the seats that the black representatives hold at the state level and at the national level. That in fact, in Alabama, there was a campaign that was something to the effect of, "We want to see," meaning us, "we want to see a rainbow flag over every black vote." And of course, some of the, and it seems to be the same type pastors as we have, like with the James Dobsons, are of course jumping on that bandwagon. And these people, the Dozier people, the Dozier fellow, he was hooked up with Jeb Bush. This was new to me until I read your information. How did that work?
Well, Dozier has ingratiated himself in with the Bush family, both in Tallahassee and in Washington, when Jeb Bush was Florida governor. And he pumped himself up as a person of importance in the black community and eventually got himself appointed to the 17th Judicial District Nominating Committee, meaning that all candidates for judges on the appellate court in Florida went through his committee for vetting. And Dozier would ask such questions as, what their belief in God was, what they felt about the Texas law striking, or the Supreme Court ruling striking down the Texas sodomy law, whether or not they would have the Ten Commandments posted in their courtrooms. All of these questions, by the way, are in violation of Article 6 of the Constitution, which clearly and unequivocally states that there shall be no religious test for a holder of any office, either federal or state. And this is in clear violation of Article 6. He reappointed after a 2-year term to a 4-year term by Jeb Bush, and then got fired by Bush because he came out and attacked the Muslim community by calling them a cult and every other thing you can think of under the sun. And that Jeb Bush was afraid of, so he removed Dozier from that commission. But Dozier has been called to the White House by George a few times to discuss things like African debt relief, along with social issues. Because, again, he has painted himself as a man of importance in the black community. And so he gets access to the corridors of power through these methods. And he's trying to, on a local level in Fort Lauderdale, you talked about driving a wedge. He is trying to drive a wedge right now between the black community and then the NAACP. Because, as you know, Julian Bond, the national president of NAACP, and the local representative, the president of NAACP, have come out on the side of the gay community in this pogrom of hate that's going on in Fort Lauderdale. And he's saying the NAACP don't know what they're talking about, they're off bases, they're wrong, don't listen to them, listen to me.
Does he always wear the paramilitary when he's doing the addressing gay and GLBT issues? Is that okay, the standard?
He wasn't in fatigues. He wears a pretty stylish suit the few times that I've seen him. It's some of his cohorts that wear the fatigues, and one in particular, and maybe somebody could call in and give his name. He's the head of one of the other Baptist organizations in Fort Lauderdale, and I can't remember his name offhand, but he wears the combat fatigues, and in fact he addressed the media wearing them that night of the press conference the night before ours. And I asked a guy that was standing next to me before I really got asked by the reporter, I said, "What's with the fatigues?" And his reply to me was, "Well, that's just something they do." But they were standing post on each side of the elevator. It was, you know, being ex-military and ex-uniform, shall we say, you know, you recognize certain things. These guys were standing post in the lobby of the city hall and at the both sides of the elevator on the 8th floor, like they were on guard duty.
My stars. This is, and if in fact then he is, because of these connections and how he's ingratiated himself, he is actually more powerful than I ever thought. I just had the concept that he was a local crazy in Fort Lauderdale. I did not realize his full level of connections. But I'm not surprised at the same time.
Right. He's managed to outreach his own significance. And, you know, he does it through the methods that a lot of these evangelical pastors do. I mean, he's basically copying the playbook from the Dobsons, Falwells, Robertsons, etc., to a more minor extent. But he's trying to accept the power that comes with the mantle that he's trying to wear, which is, you know, I'm going to the White House to advise the president. You know, just that line can open up other doors for him and get him into other places. And that's what makes him so dangerous. It's because he can go ahead and use this kind of influence to garner support for his own personal wars. The only one that I could see that really fell flat was the one that he mounted against the Muslim community, even though that did have some success in Fort Lauderdale. It wasn't a total failure. But it did get him fired off of the commission, and it got him some flack. He's not anticipating any of that kind of reaction to his anti-gay campaign, and he is definitely the leader of the anti-gay campaign.
Well, you know, this—it seems to me, you know, his distortion of the radical inclusion of Christ is mind-boggling. I understand he is fond of saying Jesus would vomit on you, meaning us. Is that true that he repeats that phrase?
He has said it to the media. He has said it to individuals who have turned around and told me. In fact, there's the press statement that I gave the press is up right now on Billy Shearer's site. The music site, you know the one I'm talking about?
Yes, I absolutely do. And in fact, that's the link to that article is on the strictlyconfidentialradio.com calendar date for you. Billy Shears is closely associated with this network. He's our music guru. I was thrilled to see you had posted there.
Excellent. Well, that article right there talks about how the events unfolded and how it affected me, because I basically had to rewrite part of that statement after leaving that meeting that I sat in and witnessed, because the dynamics changed. It shifted from a local troublemaker to somebody who was trying to claim a position on the national stage. It's just like Nagel. He can't run for mayor again. He's a lame duck. But I guarantee you, he is grooming himself for wider office, either in the state legislature, county commission, or into a media outlet like Fox News as a commentator. This is why he is involved in this anti-gay campaign, because the mayor stated in that closed conference that I was on that he was unaware how much Fort Lauderdale was being marketed to the gay community throughout the country.
Well, that's
and
a lie.
I know for a fact that when he was a member of the tourism board, there was no other member of that knew more about it than he did. And I called him on it and called him a liar during the press conference, because he is a liar.
Well, we did a report a while back. There was some indication that in Nodgel's earlier campaigns, or perhaps each campaign, and some other members, which are, in my references, remained nameless. I do not know who they are, but they were represented to be city employees, you know, on the level of the work with the mayor. Their campaigns and were pretty much financed by what we call Carl Snake Ministries here.
Yes.
Are you aware of a connection? Is that true?
It was part of that meeting that the mayor sat in on that I witnessed. I've only heard some rumors about their participation in other aspects of the mayor's life. And, of course, those kind of rumors you need to be careful of without the proper back material. But there is an investigation going on of some of the campaign finance and things like that. I believe of the last election inaugural, that could very well be part of the investigation.
Well, it was pointed out on, and I'm sorry, I go through so much, I print so many things, and honestly, I would be surrounded in stacks of paper, so I don't have it in front of me, but it came from one of the blogs. I believe we have a caller. If I'm checking with Bob in production, I believe we have a caller, Frank, who has been waiting on hold for a while to talk with us. Bob, do we still have Frank on the line?
Yes.
Good evening, Frank, and welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Oh, good evening. Listen, I was listening to the Archbishop online tonight, and I happened to see him down in Fort Lauderdale when they had that demonstration down there, and I really felt good to see him because I've always been raised Roman Catholic, and I felt the Church has rejected me. I went on the Archbishop's site, and I read a lot about his order and about the Church. And I also visited his parish in Port St. Lucie. But in doing all that, I just have one question for the Archbishop. I think I understand a lot of the historical side of it, but I wonder why he doesn't have a monastery somewhere, because I know that his priests and all are monks, are Benedictine monks.
Well, that's a good question, and the answer is simply money. And it kind of ties in with what I was talking to Peter about as far as the political realm of this goes. You know, the right will open up their wallets to build a church. Let me use Domino's Pizza, for example. The owner-founder of Domino's dedicated some ungodly amount of money, I think it was like $20 million or more, to build a church in Florida. That was going to adhere to the faith kind of Roman Catholicism. And you have many, many examples that like that on the right side of religion. On the left side, we have not been able to find a person of means to come forward and support the construction or building of our monastery, which is really the only way that I can guarantee the future of the order. We are approaching our 100th anniversary next year, and we are the oldest old Catholic religious order in the United States. But we have yet to find the material support, either in the gay community or in the progressive community in general, to properly fund us so that we could do even more than we do now. And right now we serve in nursing homes and hospices, and then our third ministry is social justice, which I personally see to. And I need a facility where I can train new priests to fulfill these vital missions. And just like Jerry Falwell wanted to build his law school for Christian lawyers, well, I need a monastery to ensure the future of the order by training men and women to carry on the fight long after I'm gone and my successor's appointed. And until we find those people of the left who are willing to do what the people on the right do, we will continue not to have the ability to have a monastery. And it does hurt.
Well, thank you, Archbishop. I can only say that I'll contact your site and talk with you about, well, maybe what I could do with the people in an area where I live, and I can only say one other thing, contrary to what somebody else you say has said, is that you and your people certainly do make God smile.
Well, thank you, Frank. I appreciate that. It's very kind of you to be here.
Thank you for joining us on Strictly Confidential, Frank. You're a wonderful, wonderful caller. You know, we say here on the network, Archbishop Simpson, that the right will give an organization $5 million and walk away and tell them to do their thing, whether, and it seems that our side will give you $2,000 and want you to account for every penny. To put it that way, but it's true. We have Michael Rajner joining us now, and Michael, welcome to Strictly Confidential.
Thank you, Peter. Hello, Archbishop. How are you?
Michael. Oh, this is Michael Rajner. How are you?
Very good.
Go ahead.
No, I just want to wanted to thank you, and you know, with Peter on the phone and the callers listening, for your having come down to Fort Lauderdale, because you really helped, along with the fellow clergy of your order and some other local clergy, really to give the true voice of what God's love is about for people, and help make the press conference we organized something that was really meaningful and spiritual. And you know, I was listening earlier when you said that you know, we went off to that meeting, and I remember when we pulled up to City Hall, because it was like the scene in Ghostbusters when the demons took over that one building. And Peter, I'm not exaggerating, you know, in South Florida, when the clouds cover over something, it is pitch black. And it was just like going up to the Tower of Evil. And, you know, after we had snuck the Archbishop into that conference room, you know, I had gone up and down the elevator a few times to take care of a few things. And it was interesting because at one point you weren't, you know, the guys that were in military garb took over the control of the elevator, and literally where they would stand in front of the buttons and ask, where are you going? You know, so really? You lost your freedom and control to even operate and function in that way. And, you know, it was really something, though, and I felt sorry to send him into the hell of den up on the 8th floor that night.
Well, you know, if you hadn't done that, Michael, and it was smart of you not to forewarn me to what you were doing, you dog, I wouldn't have been able to witness firsthand rather than hearing it from another source. But hearing it to my own ears, what their plans were and what their intent was, and that's priceless. But now that you mentioned the clouds and that, I remember as they were speaking, the heavens opened up and it rained and rained and it was lightning and everything. Because I remember looking out the window saying, yes, God, I agree with your summation of this meeting. I'd forgotten all about those clouds and that. You're absolutely right.
Hey, we had sunshine on our press conference.
Yes, we did. Oh, boy, did we ever. It must have been 100 degrees. Michael, can you remember the name of the black pastor who was in the military fatigue to address the media that night?
I can look it up, but I believe his name was covered in an article done in the Broward Times.
Uh-huh.
And he was with something like the not the Kunanan Church, but it was like the Kunanana.
Koinonia.
Yes, it was with that church.
Yes, it's the Greek word meaning as community, right.
Yeah, it's a very small church in the West Broward community, and I don't know if it's like one of those small churches out of just a small little storefront, or if it's like a church out of a garage somewhere, but it's a very small organization from what I understand.
Well, they had about, what, 10 or 12 men there that night in fatigues?
Yeah, and it really was overpowering. You didn't get to feel that, you know, it wasn't a feeling like Jesus was walking with you then.
Oh, no. No, it felt more like you were entering Dachau, actually. But let me take this opportunity, Michael, to thank you publicly for your hospitality while I was in Fort Lauderdale, for kind of being my transportation while I was there and getting me to meetings on time, and for setting up that conference. I know you did a lot of the work along with Jeff Black from Unite Fort Lauderdale. And, you know, the community owes you a debt of gratitude for the amount of work that you do. And I'm really happy that you were able to call into the program tonight.
Well, I hope that was the case, because just 2 weeks ago I sent you the editorial from Express Gay News where I was pretty much attacked for my the way in which I engaged in my type of activism. And, you know, but I know that what we did together, it brought this issue more to a national light from when I interrupted his one press conference over a month ago now. And, you know, we really, I think, brought it to where it needs to be, and the focus on the communities that this mayor has ignored, which is even far beyond the gay community. And, you know, it was sad that you had members of the African American community, and supposedly religious, standing there to support the rhetoric when, you know, this mayor really has turned his back on other communities that are struggling and in great need.
He's turned his back on the black community for most of his administration. And
still
now
does.
They're best buddies. That's the hypocrisy of the whole situation.
Yeah.
And please, before, I couldn't remember, what was that wonderful lady's name from the NAACP?
Marsha Ellison. She has been a true treasure. I will send it to you. I don't know if I have the email, but I'll scan the copy. The president of the National NAACP, I can't recall his name right now, Julian Bond.
Bond. I have that letter.
You do? Okay, he came out with a letter praising Marsha Ellison, actually, for her efforts in engaging in all the activities she did. And it was really amazing to see, though, that on the national level, she got the support she needed when she was criticized by a few fanatical individuals that really didn't care for the good of a community and pulling a community together.
Yeah, I was very impressed with Marsha, and I regret not having been able to recall her name, and was hoping you would call in so I could ask you that, to give her her credit. She was an important part of that press conference, an important part of the war in that community and on the side of the gay community.
Well, I mean, Archbishop, we even had, you know, the other thing I think that was lost in all of this is with the mayor, he only brought in members of the Christian faith. We also had Rabbi Harold Homaker, who gave a very passionate speech about discrimination. And, you know, it really showed that this mayor has just ignored other faiths and ignored freedom of religion.
Absolutely.
So I just wanted to thank you and everything. So I will...
Michael, don't rush off. I wanted to ask you about something. You mentioned a conference. I think you used the word interrupted. Now, was this the conference where Nodule was talking about the public health crisis?
Yeah, well, he had several of those. This is where he had Dr. Diggs from Massachusetts. He had to get a physician, actually, from far up north, and I'm not talking Tallahassee. He got STD and talked about anal sex and all the other wonderful or enjoyable or disgusting things. And it was really sad. I mean, he, you know, the Archbishop referenced that this mayor only wanted to attack things that happened in the gay community. He didn't have the integrity to attack on, you know, when he attacked on the sex club Slammers in Fort Lauderdale, he forgot to mention clubs like Platinum, you know, all the strippers and stripper and topless clubs that also exist. So it makes where his hate is focused very clear. And,
well, yes, of course, in Florida, your strip clubs are up and down the freeway.
Yeah, and that's the press conference where I interrupted Janet Folger, where later on her show, Faith to Action, is where she went on and, you know, they had this whole, Michael Rayner picked on a poor woman. You know, he wouldn't pick on any of the men when they were speaking, but he picked on the woman. And her, you know, she's an amazing public speaker. No one can dispute that. And she could twist and spin things as she like, but the sincerity in when she speaks about something isn't real. And I think one of the biggest things is, you know, the tactic in which I used to put that press conference pretty much to a halt and ruin the momentum that they were building, it worked. They were furious. If you go onto some of the Christian blogs, one of the articles, you know, called me the first anti-amendment bully, or anti-First Amendment bully, that was it. And, you know, a few other things. They've called me the AIDS-infected homosexual activist. You know, I mean, that's not language that's really becoming of a healthy Christian, in my opinion.
Well, it's not at all. And by the way, I too am an AIDS-infected homosexual activist, so yes, there are a lot of us out there.
I think the biggest thing I loved is when, you know, Archbishop came out of that meeting room, and, you know, before he came over to talk to the reporter, they were talking about how, you know, they were upset at the fact that the tourism board was attracting homosexuals to the Fort Lauderdale area. And it was interesting because I quickly, you know, yelled out and put my hand up and said, praise Jesus. And it was really interesting to see all their faces at first going, whoa, who just said that? You know, and then the Archbishop came over after while talking to the reporter. And his one quote said it the best, get me out of here before I get sick. And I think that's really what this whole thing has been, just sickening.
Yeah, that was a comment given to you that the reporter overheard, and she led the story with that. I said, get me out of here because I'm going to be ill.
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, she's got good ears.
I mean, you know, the mayor, though, refused to address the issue of AIDS. I mean, Fort Lauderdale, we are one of the national epicenters. We're not number one, but we do have a real big problem here. And, you know, I just spoke Tuesday before the Fort Lauderdale mayor and commissioners and basically invited them to, you know, invest financially into prevention efforts. So it's going to be interesting to see if they come forward actually with any initiatives to really address the situations. And, you know, we African-American community leads the infections in Fort Lauderdale just like anywhere else in the nation. I think there's only one or two other places. I know, like Asheville, North Carolina, where I'm going in 2 weeks, it's gay white men actually that lead the infection rates there. So it's, you know, we really need, if we're going to have leaders stand up and speak about a problem, they need to really come up with a solution and address it with integrity and true leadership.
Well, thank you for sharing that with us, Michael. Truth is hard to come by when you're talking to those folks.
Finding good leadership is something difficult. I mean, you know, Charles King of Housing Works out of New York continually says, you know, we know how to prevent AIDS. We know how to end AIDS. We just lack the political will in this nation to invest the monies and everything else to actually come out with the programs to do so. And, you know, it's where's the focus in Congress? You know, it's sending the money over or doing something else. You know, President Bush just vetoed a bill denying children health care. You know, the priorities in this nation are wrong, and we need to really, if we're going to be a Christian nation, we need to actually exercise true Christian values.
Well
said.
That's
my line, Michael.
You'll have many others.
Get your own show.
Oh, my stars.
Michael,
thank you
give my joy. Love and respect. Thank you.
Good
thank
night,
you.
Sir.
It's been very kind. Thank you, Peter.
Yes, sir. Good evening to you. Archbishop Simpson, we talked a moment there about a monastery. I think we're headed pretty much in the direction of the Benedictine Order of St. John the Beloved, and it being part of the old Catholic Church. And, you know, of course, me growing up in the South, you know, we were all Baptists and Methodists, and, you know, they're Catholics. In other words, a lot of our listeners may not fully understand how all that connects together. How exactly? What is the old Catholic Church? How did you build this? And are most of the members of the Benedictine Order gay folks? I have no clue, and I'm okay. So ignorant. I don't even know what to ask.
I'll give you the nickel tour.
Thank you.
The Roman Catholic Church is the mother church of the old Catholic Church. Essentially, a group of bishops in the Netherlands were given the authority way back during the Fourth Lateran Council, and I'm talking hundreds of years ago. They were given the authority to elect their own bishop without papal consent. And this was a right that took very seriously. And the Jesuits were always fighting that because they didn't believe it was right, so they were always causing trouble. But they really never succeeded. Vatican I came along in the 1800s, and three things got passed in Vatican I which drove that group of bishops over the edge. One was they said the Pope's infallible when he's speaking certain things. Two, that Mary, not Jesus, but Mary was born without sin. And three, and this is really how many angels dance on the head of the pin, but to them it was important in the 1800s, the third big issue was the Holy Spirit proceeds from the Father and Son instead of just the Father, because they believed in the original deposit of faith, it said the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Father. So this is what the first 1,000 years of the church believed in, and they never believed in an infallible pope, and there was no doctrine, dogma, or teaching about Mary being born without sin. Vatican I declared all those things ipso facto. Because of that, the bishops that were known as the old Catholic bishops, because they had this background where they had kind of an independence from the Pope, said, we've had it, we're making the break official, and a document called the Declaration of Utrecht was issued, kind of like our Declaration of Independence. And the old Catholics broke off from Rome in 1889. Now, when they broke off, they took all the sacraments with them, they took the rites with them, took valid apostolic succession, meaning that Most of the bishops can trace their lineage back to the Apostles of Christ, as I can, and they operated independent of the Vatican. The Vatican had no control over the old Catholic Church, and to this day it doesn't. So about 100 years ago, one of the things that moved to America was the colonel that became the first old Catholic Benedictine order in the United States. Now, the Benedictines are the oldest religious order in the world, period. There's none older. And most of the other religious orders, their rules are loosely based on the Benedictine rule. So 100 years ago, the Benedictine order of the old Catholic Church sprung up here in the United States. And it ended up from Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, to Woodstock, New York. As it evolved through the years, it's had its succession of bishops, just like any diocese, any other order would. And I took over in 1999. Now, one of the changes I made is that I added St. John the Beloved to the name of the order, so that it is now the Benedictine Order of St. John the Beloved. And I did that because of who St. John the Beloved was. And he was the disciple that never denied Christ. He was the disciple that Jesus so loved. He was the disciple that was really favored by Jesus. And he was the only disciple to die of old age of natural causes, whereas all the other ones were executed and martyred. And I thought, well, Benedict's rule and life of Benedict is one guidepost, and the guidepost of John the Beloved, his total faith and love in Christ and what he stood for, is our other guidepost. So since 1999, this order that started 100 years ago has been known as the Benedictine Order of St. John the Beloved. I am the current Archbishop Abbot of the order, and when I die or retire one day, there will be a successor appointed after me, who will also be in valid apostolic succession, meaning that we are legitimate in the eyes of Rome, although Rome hates us, basically. They say we're illicit, meaning that we're illegal. Well, the response to that, Peter, is, and not to get too legalistic on you, but the Lateran Council, which was a major council of the church, said no future pope, no future council, no future anything can ever revoke the rights that we have here established for this group of bishops and their lineage. I don't care what this pope says over there, what the Vatican says, it is immaterial. We draw our authority from the Fourth Lateran Council hundreds of years ago. It remains true today as it did then, and Rome has to accept it. And if you ask a Roman Catholic bishop in the diocese, are our sacraments valid? If they don't answer yes, then they're wrong. And I've had to call one bishop out on the carpet for that already once. And he conceded and apologized to us because he objected to one of my clergy giving the last rites to somebody who was dying because they couldn't get a Roman priest. So that's kind of it. We're independent from Rome, but we're just as Catholic as Rome, but we have no allegiance to the Pope, and he can't pick up the phone or call me and tell me to do nothing. I don't have to answer to him. I am an archbishop. I am as high as you can go in the old Catholic Church. We do not have cardinals. We do not have popes. We have archbishops and bishops.
Wow. So I had no idea who I had. This is amazing. This has got to be incredibly frustrating to you if you're one of the oldest religious orders, I think maybe it was the way you phrased it, to have this legion of, I can only call, upstarts, screaming in your face and misquoting the Gospels.
Yes.
You must have to bite your tongue.
The fact of it is, Peter, is that one of the bottom lines here is that all of these pastors, the African-American pastors that sat in that conference room that night, had available to them the same theology, the same history of the church to them that I've had to me. For example, the story that they love to throw out, Sodom and Gomorrah. How many times have you heard that story? Well, in my public statement to the press, I probably overdid a little bit, but I tried to point out to them that it was not homosexuality. It was not the sin of Sodom and Gomorrah. The sin was in hospitality to strangers. And we can track, historically, in church history, the fact that it was about the 12th century when the
emphasis of Sodom and Gomorrah switched over to homosexuality. It was the same century that the same-sex union rite of the Roman Catholic Church disappeared. There was a rite from the 3rd to the 12th century for uniting two people of the same sex. It disappeared the same time that the story of Sodom and Gomorrah changed over to what's been known ever since. And everybody forgets that God sent two angels to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah prior to them ever entering into the city of Sodom to be attempted to rape or whatever they say that was going to happen. That decision was foregone, and it was foregone because of the way, the wickedness of the people, the way they treated strangers. Because in those days, Peter, nomads, that their seeds of life were seated in places where you could go for cover, for food, for drink. It was very important that you, when you ran into an oasis or a town in the middle of nowhere where somebody's tent, that you offered that stranger what you had to share, because it meant life. That's the kind of hospitality we're talking about.
Well, yes, it was a death sentence if you didn't. There weren't Holiday Inns
to
pull it. Right.
You bet.
It was...
and Sodom and Gomorrah, and there are other like situations in the scriptures for other cities. They were apparently well known for being very selfish, very hedonistic, very pleasure seeking. They didn't care about strangers, when the angels came in, they didn't care whether or not the men were fed or whatever. They said to Lot, bring them out so that we may know them. Well, to know them, there's about four translations to the phrase, because you have to remember, we're talking about scriptures that went from Hebrew to Aramaic, from Aramaic to Greek, from Greek to Latin, from Latin to the Romance languages. You've got it's like that old school game you'd play. And when you were in grade school, you'd line up and you'd whisper something in the first kid's ear, and you'd whisper the next. Well, when it got to the other end of the line, it was born in resemblance to what the first kid whispered.
I agree. We've talked about the book Misquoting Jesus here, which Absolutely. Runs along this. Yes.
And these teachers use because they are literalists and fundamentalists, and they believe that Jesus was a stenographer following him around everywhere, who typed every word that everybody said. Well, that's not the truth. The truth mm-hmm. is that it started as an oral tradition. There was no writing for at least 70 years. There was nothing written down that's become to be known as the Gospels. It was oral. It was passed on from person to person orally. There was no stenographer. And to see that you know that what was said definitely by Jesus is arrogance. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
Well, I'm fascinated by everything you're saying. But one of the things, I've heard it for so long about the rite of joining two people of the same sex that disappeared from the Catholic Church. Can you tell us more about that? I wish I knew more about that.
Yes, there's been a few researchers. The most prominent was Professor John Boswell of Yale University, who unfortunately died of AIDS in, I believe, I'm going to say 1980. The researchers uncovered evidence of a rite which, and I wrote for those who have never heard the term used in this respect, is basically a ceremony, okay, that whose purpose is to perform a function that's basically recognized by the church practicing it. And using John Boswell's research and some others, I've reconstructed the rite in the back of my book, The Gift Face of God, and I've updated some language because it was very hard in places to read because of the style of language used. And also it had some crazy things, like you had to run around the altar three times while you had crowns held over your heads and stuff. And I just couldn't see it happening in a church today. So, you know, I eliminated things like that, but I basically reconstructed the site based on the scholars' research. And according to Boswell and others, the rite basically disappeared underground 12th century and has never reappeared until people like Boswell started sticking their nose into the ground and finding things and even coming up with some artifacts that showed two members of the same sex on pottery
that were being portrayed in an obvious atmosphere of what would have been called a wedding or a union. It never referred to as a wedding or marriage, but it was referred to as a union, a same-sex right union. And that's, I've used, personally, I've used that right about 100 times. I married 60 couples on a cruise ship, as a matter of fact, one of the gay cruises a few years ago. And I'm going to use it again in 20 days for a lesbian couple here in Pennsylvania. But this right, now Rome will tell you that I'm full of brown stuff, but I'll trust the researchers and the scholars that did the work that I've read that I believe, which makes sense to me.
Well, you've made a very powerful statement in some of the material I've been looking through, at least it was to me, and it's not related necessarily to this in particular, the right of joining two people of the same sex, but to marriage in general. I believe, how did you phrase it? You say the church doesn't marry people anyway. The church just witnesses it?
That's correct, yeah.
Tell us more about that. I was fascinated by that concept.
Well, the purpose of the minister is basically to witness the vows that are exchanged between the couple before the Lord. The minister represents God and a physical representation. And basically, the minister witnesses that exchange of vows and says, because you have exchanged these vows, you are now man and wife, after the exchange of the rings, etc. The church really doesn't marry. And if you take the history of marriage, it goes back to being a civil contract because it was a conveyance of property. And the property being conveyed was the woman, because the woman belonged to her father, or her brother if the father was not alive. And when she married, that property was conveyed to the husband. And so a contract was formed to facilitate that transference. So this was a civil thing only. And the church came along and said, whoa, there's something we don't have control over. We make that something we want to get involved in, and we want to control how people become man and wife. And basically, that's a simplified version of it. That's what happened. It went from being simply a civil action, a property transfer, to come under church control and become what it has become down through the ages to what it is today.
Well, there are several questions coming up from production chat. Actually, I'm monitoring actually two rooms. One is, what is the difference between your order and the sect that, say, Mel Gibson fronts that rejects Vatican II?
Very, very good question. Mel Gibson funds a different wing of the old Catholic Church. And if I had to say that we had a radical right-wing section, it would be bad, because one of their tenets of belief is the Holocaust never happened. Some of their teachings are pre-Vatican. They take a lot of the principles of the Vatican councils and either twist them or destroy them totally, even the good ones. And it's a very rigid God of lust, God of fire and brimstone. Now, and I get in trouble for saying this all the time, and I'm going to say it again, and I'll get in trouble probably again. To me, there are two gods that are depicted in the Bible. The God of the Old Testament has always been portrayed as a God who is punishes, a God who has Abraham try to sacrifice his son, a God who destroys Sodom and Gomorrah, i.e. the New Testament is more of a God of love, a God who so loved us that he gave us his only begotten son, who is the pure definition of love. And I'm accused by the Jewish community of being anti-Semitic because of that characterization. I don't see it that way, and it's certainly not the way I mean it. It's what I see as what I read. So Mel Gibson is supporting, and I think his support's now up to 20 million, because he's taken a big chunk of the profits from Pride, Passion of the Christ, put them directly into that California parish. He has pumped $20 million into the ultra-right wing of the old Catholic Church. And yes, we do have some the same nuts that all the rest of the churches have.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that the Jewish community, you know, the Christian right wing, you know, firmly wants to grab a hold of, like, the laws of Leviticus and let's just say the whole Testament in general. However, we did a story back in July, which reads, last winter, 25 conservative Jewish Baptists, or rather Jewish rabbis, pardon me, I'm in Florida, God deliver me, Jewish rabbis shut themselves in a room at a Park Avenue synagogue and emerged 2 days later with the pronouncement that gays and lesbians may be ordained as rabbis. Now, it seems to me that these people have a much better grasp of the Old Testament than, I'm just trying to fathom that.
Well, I know what you're speaking of, and I guess the common sense answer to that would be, first of all, they speak and read Hebrew, and Aramaic, so they can actually go back to original texts and not depend on a 21st century translation of a translation of 10 times over. So, you know, if you want to know the truth of something, you always go back to the original, the first document that you can. Even though it may not be the earliest, as in, like I said earlier, about the oral tradition before it became writing. But in this case, they can go back to the original Talmud and look, see what it says. And unfortunately, I didn't read too much about that event, but my assumption is that they went in and they read and they read and they talked and they discussed and they studied and they said, you know, there really is a reason why we can't ordain gay and lesbian. And I could talk, you know, for 4 hours on the gay issues in the Bible and St. Paul. And I think that's probably the bottom line. I'd be surprised if I'm not too far off on that.
I agree. Production chat is also pointing out that the Jewish reading of the Sodom story is precisely as you told us, and also that this hospitality theme carries through in the Muslim faith also. But there's a question.
Okay.
Well, there's another point here. I'm actually getting a question. Isn't the government refusing? Or isn't the refusal of any civil government to recognize a church's marriage of a gay couple, isn't that a direct violation of the church's First Amendment rights?
Well, my undergrad degree is in law, thanks to the University of Central Florida, by the way. Peter, you've been correct in everything but my alumni.
Okay.
UCF needs credit. That's an interesting perspective, except that marriage is a civil contract and is founded in common law. It is not a law of a church. A church, which makes one of the arguments for against same-sex marriages, well, it'll force all churches to recognize and to perform weddings. That's nonsense. It's never been true. It will never be true. A church will be free to either perform a wedding for a same-sex couple or not to perform a wedding according to their own tenets of faith. Now, if you come to a priest of my order or to many, many branches of the old Catholic Church, you will more than likely be able to get married in an old Catholic church, except unless Mel Gibson's on the board of directors. Forget about it. So it's really not... you can't make an argument saying that it's a violation of the church's rights under the Constitution, because the reverse is true. The right starts with civil law, and the church witnesses marriage. Keep thinking like that, but no, it doesn't work like that, unfortunately.
I see. Well, the second part of the question is that if the government is only recognizing weddings that are performed between male and female couples, mm-hmm. then the government itself is engaging in the establishment of religion. It seems to me, or seems to our production, seems to Bob.
Well,
I thought it was a good question.
Well, Bob, we go back to the premise that marriage is a civil contract and has really got nothing to do with churches. Anybody can get a marriage license down at the courthouse and be married by a justice of
peace. It doesn't take the church to marry you. It takes the civil authority to marry you. Now, civil authority is granted to clerical members to perform the ceremony, but you don't need a church member or a church clergy person to do that. You could keep it entirely in the civil realm, like many people do.
Well, tell us about somehow you're involved in the Anglican Church. How does it cross over? Because it seems I'm getting the impression in reading that you are somehow related to Gene's appointment. Am I reading that entirely incorrectly? How does it work with the Anglican
no,
or the Episcopal?
That would be an incorrect interpretation, Peter. But you're not to be held guilty for that because this isn't an easy thing. First of all, there's Father Bruce Simpson, if you Google it, who's an Anglican, who's not me. Second, the Anglican Church and the Old Catholic Church are in communion with each other. And what that means is that we recognize the validity of their orders, they recognize the validity of our orders. I perform a lot of our ordinations in that in Episcopal churches. In an emergency, one of my priests can conduct an Episcopal Mass, and vice versa. It's that kind of thing. It's something called the Lambeth Conference, where this was all ironed out. I believe, and I'm not positive, but I think it was 1941 that took place. So our churches are in communion with each other, but we are not the same church. First of all, the Anglican Church is Protestant. We are Catholic.
Okay, that cleared that up for me. What happened to you in 2004? Apparently, there were verbal or attacks from both Arkansas and Texas. I don't know all about that. What was that about? It was huge.
That was kind of a nightmare, and it's the basis of my second book, which is titled Unequal Justice: Being Gay in America. The Gay Face of God came out and was selling rather well, and I was a regular contributor to The Advocate. I had written for Genre Magazine and for several others. And an individual in Texas who was a bishop of a radical branch of old Catholicism and basically a nutcase in Arkansas took it upon themselves to attack me on the internet to the point where they accused me of being naked with kids, that I was a child molester, that I was engaged in the smuggling of aliens from Florida to California. And they took this so far that they phoned in a complaint to the U.S. Treasury Department's Office of the Inspector General alleging that I had used prior law enforcement connections to harass them and their churches. And the U.S. Treasury wasted 7 months and a lot of money investigating me over nothing for a false complaint. And this got pretty bad. There were death threats issued against me and my partner, Jack, who I've been with 34 and a half years. And there were implications that they were going to come to Pennsylvania and do this and do that. And so I warned them that they needed to withdraw that stuff and to retract it, or that I would take action. They laughed at me and said, "Do what you want. We have photographs of you naked with kids." And meanwhile, the internet spiders had picked up all this. So if you Googled my name or the name of our order, all this kind of garbage would come up. So I filed a federal lawsuit in the Middle District of Pennsylvania against John Parnell, the Mexican National Catholic Church, and Montgomery, whatever his last name was, in Arkansas. I had to do this myself because I could get no support from HRC, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, GLAAD, Lambda Legal, any national gay group you could think of didn't want to touch the case. It was either no publicity in it for them, there was no money in it for them, there was not enough reason for them. I was totally on my own. Lawyers who were gay or gay-friendly wanted up to $300 an hour to work on the case. So putting my outstanding degree from the University of Central Florida to work, I basically
opened an account with LexisNexis and one of the other legal research businesses, and I filed the suit myself in Pennsylvania. And it took a lot of effort and more money to get them both served because they refused U.S. mail service. I had to have the guy in Arkansas served by a U.S. Marshal and the guy in Texas served by a constable during a funeral procession, by the way. The judge here in Pennsylvania called for a hearing. He allowed the guy in Arkansas to appear via monitor rather than coming here to Pennsylvania. They couldn't get the other guy at all, so it was just me and the one guy on the monitor. I had very well researched the law, which is all printed out in the book. And it clearly states in there, Peter, the guy in Arkansas was a British citizen. He was not an American. He was here illegally and, in fact, had been convicted of misdemeanor offenses here in America. The law clearly states if you are an alien, you have no right to be sued in your own jurisdiction. The plaintiff shall have all rights in consideration. And what that means is that the trial should have taken place here. The judge here didn't want anything to do with this case. It was a gay case. It was nasty. It was ugly. It was icky. And he was going to dismiss it out of hand for lack of jurisdiction in the face of the law that I had quoted. So just before he banged the gavel, I interrupted him and said, well, in lieu of you finding jurisdiction, I move to transfer this case to the court in Arkansas. And the judge asked me, can I do that? And I said, yes, Your Honor, you can do that. And so he said, I will take that under advisement, banged a gavel. 10 days later, he did transfer the case to Arkansas. And what that meant was I didn't have to file again in court in Arkansas and pay another $250. So it was important to me. Long story short, Peter, this drug went on for 15 months. The guy in Arkansas burnt the house he was living down and fled the scene, is wanted for arson under a felony arrest warrant, and according to Homeland Security, fled America and went back to Wales. Texas, there was another hearing called. I showed up in the courtroom in Arkansas. Parnell of Texas failed to show up, and so it was only I. I testified for an hour on the stand, asked a million questions by the judge. And then when he issued his decision, it was not in my favor because even though I was accused of being a child molester and all the other litany of charges, I could not show financial damage.
Aww.
And because of that, he dismissed the case but would consider awarding costs. Now, the law states in order to award costs, I've got to be the victor of the case. So, once again, the law is bended to, you know, our whims. So I ended up with a judgment for $1,000-some-odd, which is what I spent on the case, including travel costs to Arkansas. It was reduced to a judgment, and the judgment has remained unpaid because the defendant will not pay it, and it's only a grand, so nobody will really put much effort into collecting it.
Well, have the internet references dissipated?
Yes. When this guy Montgomery, his nickname was Father Monty, who was arrested for spanking boys, by the way.
Oh,
when he fled, his website collapsed, and all of the garbage collapsed with it. I had copies of all of it, and it's all in the book what he had written, and how the whole thing evolved, and how it turned out. Because I had also asked for an injunction against both parties from ever repeating that garbage. That was also denied by the judge. And he said, if they do it again, you can always come back to court and ask again. Well, that would mean filing a new lawsuit instead of granting the injunction to protect my reputation. It was very hard on me. Medically, it was hard on me. They were saying that they had commenting in my house, and they were reporting that I had AIDS and that my partner had AIDS, and that our house was darkened, and on and on. It was just the most outrageous, incredible nonsense you ever want to see.
So this is something Jack had to go through, too.
Yes, yes. Now, Tom Cruise can say, oh, he called me gay, and go to court, sue somebody, and, you know, wins $1 million. And somebody that put me through that kind of hell, including death threats, got off the hook scot-free, basically.
Wow. Well, on a lighter note, apparently you have interviewed Jason and DeMarco. Now, this is terribly interesting to me because I recently did an interview with a lesbian. They're singers and they have a gospel ministry. Susie Brenner, they're a couple, Susie Brenner and Linda Beckstead of Brenner and Beckstead. And in looking through I had not heard of Jason DeMarco, and I'm fascinated by this. This is a male couple that does a gospel ministry.
Wonderful. I got them the cover actually of the Advocate December. Issue of the Advocate that year that I did the interview with them. Jason and DeMarco are lovers. They've been lovers for about 3 years now, 4 years. Both had independent singing careers prior to meeting each other. DeMarco actually had toured Italy singing with an operatic group. They both have incredible voices. They have sung at one of the ordinations I've done, and I have a CD of the music that they sang for it that they cut for me because it was all the old Christian, the Gregorian kind of things that are done during ordinations.
Wow.
And they became lovers. They joined their music careers together, started out in strictly a spiritual pop kind of thing, and now they've kind of widened out into a more generalized pop while still keeping it on a spiritual basis. They support the Trevor Project heavily. They're members of the Sunshine Cathedral in Fort Lauderdale. They consider that their home parish. DeMarco was Roman Catholic. He's not anymore. Jason was brought up Assembly of God, which, of course, is
fabulous. What a couple.
Yeah, I mean, talk about, I don't know. I remember asking him, did you have to handle snakes and stuff while you were at it? I love those boys to death. They're extreme, great personalities, beautiful voices. They love each other deeply. They are quite active now. They've become very successful. They have a good management company behind them. They sing at HRC dinners, and they're even premiered on gay cruises sometimes for MCC. They're usually an act for MCC, and they're just a beautiful couple. And anybody who's never heard them can go to their site. They can go to our site, and there's a link on our site to them.
Ah, good. I didn't know.
Early supporter of them, and I will always be a supporter of Jason DeMarco. So if you go to our links page on our website, you'll see a link that says Jason and DeMarco, and just go with that.
Well, that's wonderful news. If you happen to come across them in a conversation, please mention I would love to have them on the show. I really would.
Certainly.
They're a perfect fit for me. It's just exactly that. I just find that fascinating. And one of the things this program does is attempts to expose the stereotypes, and we do that every time we have a guest, and you know, a couple of lesbians doing a gospel ministry or these guys doing a singing ministry just blows every stereotype in the book. So it's,
oh yeah, and they'll be the first to admit it.
Well, that's great.
And you cannot argue with their God-given talent.
Wonderful.
The purity of their voices and the notes they hit. And it's just incredible. I wish that Bob had this one CD. I'd have him play one of the songs that DeMarco did for me during that ordination. And one of them was Ave Maria, but he also did some others. He did the Litany of the Saints, which if you're Catholic or Anglican, you know what that is. But they're a beautiful couple, and I can't say enough good things about them.
Wonderful. Well, I'll certainly remember that, and if I can get them on, and we'll upload those tracks to the studio.
I'll send them an email and tell them to get in contact with you.
Yay. Peter at headonradionetwork.com works nicely. We did a story a while back about gay pride, the gay pride in Jerusalem, and how the ultra-Orthodox... it was terrible. There were people arrested with there was a pipe bomb, I think, or something with gasoline in it, and
Molotov cocktails and sticks with nails in the end.
And apparently there was rioting for days and days afterwards in the ultra-Orthodox communities, setting garbage bins on fire. That and they were even talking about withholding funds from those communities because they were causing so much damage to street lights and the whole bit, because they were, but I'm reading an article you did for The Advocate, and there's a detail that I had no idea when we reported this. There were flyers mailed out offering Israeli citizens $4,500 to kill anyone who is gay.
Correct.
Tell us about that. I'm horrified by that, and it's an aspect of that story I didn't do because I didn't know.
Yeah, I wrote about that. It got wide play, the article did, and I got flack for it as recent as two nights ago from a couple in our Fort St. Lucie parish. It is a sect that is known as a radical right-wing sect in Jerusalem. I cannot remember the name offhand because I don't have the documents at my fingertips, but they are the principal motivator for all of the anti-gay movement in Israel. And I have to jump in quick and say that's the minority. The majority of Israelis apparently are very pro-gay, and you can be openly gay and serve in the Israeli army and things like that. I'm not saying it's a dream world, but I'm sure there's some problems. But I think holistically, it is a very good country for a gay man or woman to be in. However,
yes,
there is this sect, and when World Pride was going to come there, they announced that they were going to do everything they could to stop it. And in fact, the year before the time I wrote about, one of their members stabbed three of the parade goers and is in jail. And they named the stick with the nails in it after him. So if his name was Muda, it's now called the Muda stick. You hit somebody with a nail sticking out of them and you're going to kill them or hurt them severely. So there were three gay people that were stabbed the year before this. Gay Pride, the World Pride was canceled to prevent rioting because I was supposed to go there and cover it for the now defunct Q television network. They maintain their anti-gay philosophy to this day. And they do offer a $4,500 reward for the death of a gay person. They're big on flyers. They're big on Molotov cocktails and things like that. I would suspect their numbers are small, probably maybe a couple hundred, and I'm guessing here, but my impression from when I looked into this was that it was, that kind of a small sect. They are on the police watch list in Israel, and they're not representational of the Jewish people in general, but they do exist.
Well, the general understanding amongst us here is that fundamentalism of any stripe is always a bad thing. You're certainly not going to get any flack about it here. You're simply reporting a fundamentalist group, regardless of...
Yes, well, I immediately became anti-Semitic because I said something bad about an Israeli group. There was a blog on the internet that a Jewish guy ran out of New York, and I was attacked on that, and there was some flack. As a matter of fact, the piece was published in The Advocate, and The Advocate got some letters, and they published one of the letters, and I talked to the editor, and Bruce Steele at the time, and Bruce said, "I know what you meant, and we all do, but You know, it's our policy. If we can, we have the space, we print no matter what. And I say, oh, I don't care. That's fine. But, yes, I was reporting on a matter of fact. But because it was a Catholic archbishop saying something that was anti-Israeli, it became news, and the piece went around the world. Much like my response to Pope John Paul II's edict in June of, what year was that, 98, when he put out that thing on anti-gay marriage and what to do with the gay community. And I issued a very well-constructed response that also went around the world. I was interviewed in Australia by ABC and some other places on that. And it turns out that it was probably the major response to the edict issued by John Paul II. Of course, I had no idea when writing it that was going to have the prominence that it did, but it did. And
it seems to me it's in such direct contradiction to one of your primary missions. And one of your primary missions is social justice ministry.
Yes.
And it just seems so. It seems to completely ignore that elephant in the room.
Well, and that's just it. You know, some of my advisors counsel me to stay away from certain hot button issues. But you know what? If we don't take on some of these issues, nobody's going to.
Nobody will.
And you know, after you go through a Texas militia thing, you know, you really. Don't worry about getting attacked for something you say later on. I am ex-law enforcement, and I do carry a firearm in Pennsylvania. I'm licensed to carry. I go to the firing range regularly with police friends of mine. And it's not so much to protect myself as it is those with me, because I would be incredibly destroyed if somebody was trying to get at me and instead took out Jack or... you know, my mother or somebody that was with me, a friend.
I'm also very curious about your ministry to the elderly. You know,
yes.
as the GLBT or LGBT community ages, our needs are somewhat different than...
Yes.
than you know, many times as we're older, we become socially isolated. Our partners, or we either don't have a partner, or our partner has passed away. Is this part of your outreach to the LGBT community? Tell us about your elderly ministry.
Well, as you see on our website, we basically have the three ministries: nursing homes, hospices, and social justice, and then followed by that is parish formation. But that's really the fourth one. Our priest, like in Port St. Lucie, is Father Bernie Sheffield. He keeps an eye out for gay nursing home people that are residents, and also in hospice. If he knows that the person is gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, he makes a special effort to make sure that person. Has what they need at the time. He's been known to sit there and hold their hand for hours. He makes an effort to bring in the partner if the partner's in the area, and to make sure the partner has as much access as possible to his loved one or her loved one. He has a good relationship with the administrators of the nursing homes and hospices. So when he goes and asks and says, you know, this person may not be legally related, but they are related, and I would like them to be together. The nursing homes will usually say, sure, Father, go ahead. And he makes sure that they get together. That's what we can do on a practical basis. And then once the person passes on, if there are no other arrangements made, one of our clergy can take care of burial arrangements and make sure that the partner of the gay person is given the same position that a wife or husband would be in a heterosexual situation. Because in our eyes, a couple that has been together for years is a gift from God, and the love is to be respected as if it was a heterosexual couple. Neither one is better than the other. They're equal in our eyes.
And so we make sure that we tend to the living as well as the dead, because the dead are gone, and it's the living that are left. And that's where the pain is.
Well, another aspect of this that's particularly frightening to me is many of us have lived a life where we were open, and at least in the gay community, maybe in the community at large, but we were out, and sometimes when you go into a nursing home situation, some of these people are having to go back in the closet.
Yes.
Yes, and it seems to be a horrifying thing to go through.
It is. And there's been some blogging on this, and I remember on one blog I wrote that, you know, the gay youth of today better start caring about this issue, because one day they will be the gay elderly that are in this situation. And it is, I think, one of the ultimate injustices that we have to deal with as a community, that after a life of struggle and success, mostly, of fighting the closet door and succeeding, that in our final days that we would have to be pushed back in. I, for one, will never permit that to happen to me or my loved ones. I have found in this world that you've got to stand on your own two feet and demand what is right. And when that demand's not met, then you take the corrective action that's available to make it happen. And, you know, a lot of what the gay community can do, regardless of what Congress does with our relationships, is to paper our relationships. And by that I mean living wills, final wills, power of attorneys, medical power of attorneys. There are legal documents and methods to secure rights for us that won't be given to us. But when they say you can't be in this room, and you whip out a piece of paper that's notarized and follow the proper procedures along and say, oh, yes, I can, that's the end of the discussion.
Well, there are, and more, especially in Florida, we see it, retirement home assisted living, privately owned assisted living facilities, mm-hmm. I think in Arizona too, that cater to the gay community, but those are
yes.
for money, people with money.
Oh, yes, they are very expensive. It's a money-making business for both worlds, I mean. But especially for the gay ones, yeah, sure, you can live a fine retirement and a fine assisted living and a fine hospice care in some of these brand-new gay communities, but you better have a lot of bucks to do it. And that's just not the reality for most of our gay community, no matter what the myths say about our salaries. Again, you're going to be in hopefully you'll be able to find a way to stay home and be cared for at home, which I think is part of the trend that we're seeing, is that the government's saying it's going to be cheaper to keep you in your house and to send people to you than to put you under a roof and then feed you and take care of you. And I hope that's a trend that continues. However, if you find yourself in a public entry-level kind of nursing home, whether it's private or not, again, it's one of these things where you've got to stand up for your rights. You know, it's certainly not something I would counsel, but if you've got a male or a female partner that's in a private home, and the only way that you can be part of that is to maybe say that that's my brother, that's my stepbrother, and if that'll get you in there and with that person through the last days, then go ahead and do it. You know, if there's no way to stand up on your own two feet and fight for the gay position, then go in with the he's my stepbrother issue. How are they going to know the difference?
Yeah, well, this is true. We're running to about, three, 4 minutes left in the program, and I do not want to leave you without giving you the opportunity to tell us about there's a cookbook. There's apparently wine with a good reputation. Tell us about that. Apparently, and these would go toward the $5 billion gift for the monastery, hopefully.
Yes. Well, the budget for the monastery is $3 million, and that actually covers building the monastery, buying the land, building a church for the monastery, as well as making it a public parish, and then a retreat center as well. The retreat center would become a source of income to support the parish. So the $3 million has been carefully budgeted and is really for an overall complex and not just for a building. There are cookbooks that are on sale through the parish in Florida and through the mail. I think the price is like $5.
And then you can find that at osjtb.org, if is
right.
That correct?
Right. Right. And all donations are tax-deductible, by the way, because we are, obviously, just like any other church, 501c3. Now, there's something like the cookbook, however, you're getting something of value in return for the money, so that's not deductible. So, you know, if you buy a cookbook, say, for $5, that's $5 for the cookbook. You're getting something of value for the cookbook. So that's where that goes. But if you happen to know of any millionaires that are laying around with a guilty conscience, you might want to give them my phone number and tell them that I might be able to help them.
As we would like you to mention 877, the number 4 head on. We're in the same boat, and it's just terrible. All of us in the progressive, the gay community, we work so hard, and often we feel like just screaming with the just don't care attitude. Not from everybody, mind you.
Yes.
Now,
in Port St. Lucie, we've got some people who took the bull by the horns. And they went in and they redid the church. They put new carpeting in. There was painting done. They poured their hearts out into the place to make it a beautiful place of worship. So there are exceptions to that, believe me. But you know, the mega rich of our community, and there is no shortage of them, believe me, they are just so tight with their wallets, or they're so anti-religion that they've been of no help to us. And even a person who was an expert fundraiser who would come along and say, I offer my services to help you try and raise the money, that would be welcomed as well.
Well, I have to say, you have been a marvelous guest. And also, I don't think we've scratched the surface.
Not really,
we could have you on for weeks and still not get to the bottom of your story. I believe I speak universally. We would love to have you back at some point in the future.
I'd be happy to, and by the way, I'm in negotiations for my own radio or TV show at the temporary time right now.
Way cool, and this is in Florida?
Yes, the TV studio's in Florida, and the TV broadcasters got offices in Florida, Palm Springs, and Canada.
Well, that's marvelous. Now, we could do a whole show on just that. Please keep us posted.
You've got my phone number, Peter.
I sure do. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
You're quite welcome.
Aroused a lot of interest, and thank you for being with us. Good night.
God bless you all.
You too. What a wonderful guest. We're truly blessed with wonderful guests here. Don't know how, why, or what, but somehow God works for us. We just so grateful to have folks like that who are in our community and willing to speak with us. I want to tell you that next week will be an interesting week on Strictly Confidential. We have, and this is perhaps a radio first, we have next week, next Tuesday, this coming Tuesday on the 9th, a heterosexual crossdresser will be on the show. It's something that is never talked about, and we have someone who is willing to talk about it. It should be fascinating because none of us know anything about that. So that's probably all the time I have this evening. Thank you so much for joining us. And in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you to...